Welcome to Be Honest Podcast with Dr. Yana and Dr. Sherry, where we hold honest conversations about life, relationships, challenges, and everything in between, with unfiltered discussions with real people, offering their authentic stories, experiences, and perspectives. No topic is off limits and no story is too small. Join us on United Public Radio Network 107.7 FM.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to United Public Radio 107.7 live from New Orleans, Louisiana. If you're enjoying our content, don't forget to hit the like button and subscribe to Be Honest Talks for more updates and exciting stories. We love sharing our thoughts and ideas on this show, so keep in mind that our content isn't personalized advice. We're a couple, enthusiastic voices with strong opinions. Take us with a grain of salt, a dash of humor, and always trust your gut. Come along with us on Be Honest Talks podcast with Dr. Yana and Dr. Sherry to explore what drives people to embrace darkness, committing acts of unspeakable violence. Stay with us as we go deep into the psyche of a killer, exploring the tangled web of motivations, traumas, and psychological factors that lead some down the path of darkness, or as some say, the path of no return. I mean, how can one ever come back from committing a heinous crime? Dr. Yana, why don't you intrigue our minds with questioning this topic?
Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. It is so good to be back here with you again and with the fabulous Dr. Sherry. Dr. Sherry is not only fabulous, she is beautiful. She's fantastic with incredible, inquisitive mind. She is fantastic. So I was going to say we're live from New York. It's Saturday night. We're live from New Orleans. It's Friday afternoon.
That's cute.
Yeah, but to be serious, of course, I did not even know what to wear today. You know, I thought like, okay, but if for this kind of a topic, I thought I made my hair, like I put some like bright, what is this, things into my hair. And then I thought like, oh, no, this topic is too dark. I cannot be bright and shiny, like looking like a sunshine. I can't do that.
Well, you always look like sunshine. So you bring sunshine wherever you go.
Thank you. Thank you. Mm-hmm. But today is a very interesting topic. So as we begin, what aspects of probing the mind of a killer intrigue or unsettle you the most? Is it the search for motives, the exploration of psychology, or the chilling realization of the human capacity of darkness? Interesting questions. I know that I myself, I can't say intrigued by the serial killers, but I have been intrigued by psychopathology. That is for sure. And psychopathology should be, I believe, researched and investigated by people, even if they don't have a degree in psychology, because it is a fascinating topic in terms of we must be able to protect ourselves from this individuals. I can't really call them people, probably individuals. For me, individuals is something maybe more inhumane. However, if we speak about Jung, there is a process of individuation, right? So where we, in fact, become humans. So perhaps they did not go through the process and they remain in an animal state. However, there are different kind of killers, right, Dr. Sherry? Not yes. Necessarily a lot of them have psychopathologies, right?
No, it happens just oftentimes overlap. So I think many of them do have what we would consider antisocial personality disorder, maybe narcissistic personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, maybe a splash of histrionic personality disorder. I think they all suffer from some kind of a personality disorder in that category.
Histrionic. I did not even know that. Interesting.
Histrionic, I believe, somewhat compares to borderline personality disorder. It has a lot of influential, maybe a little bit more seeking of attention.
A lot of the times go side by side. Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the pathology of the mind of a killer is a very complex subject, which has been the focus of extensive research and inquiry in the field of psychology and also criminology, which you, of course, Dr. Sherry, researched in depth, and also psychiatry and the understanding of the underlying psychological and neurological factors that contribute to violent behavior is crucial for both prevention and intervention efforts. So let's explore some of the key factors that may contribute to the development of the killer's mindset, as well as the implications for society and mental health professionals.
Like the psychosocial, biopsychosocial elements, like biologically, yes. like you just said, neurologically, like the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex tend to be highlighted in these types of disorders, because that's where our emotions are regulated, and that's where our cognitive processes occur. So people who tend to have these personality disorders, such as psychopathy, tend to have like a emotional deficit or empathetic deficit. Right. So it has to do with that part of the biological system in the brain, the neurological system. However, you know, are we born this way? So we start to cross the topic of human psychology.
Yes. So how would you explain, are we really born that way? Or we become. I know that with the psychopathologies, of course, that we can't put everything into one bucket and say, yeah, that we're born this way. Because with different personality disorders, right, the origin is different. But in your opinion, if people come to commit such atrocious acts, are they normally made this way during their childhood, perhaps, experiences, or some of them are born that way?
I do think some people are born to be prone to maybe psychosis or psychotic disorders. Someone suffering from perhaps a psychotic disorder such as schizophrenia, they may commit heinous crimes based on the auditory hallucinations or whatever their mental state is telling them that they should commit these crimes. However, I think a majority of psychopaths are created. They're, you know, it's people aren't born monsters, I believe. I believe they're created. John Douglas, he's a very famous criminal profiler, and he speaks about the homicidal triad or the triangle of homicide. That speaks about childhood. It speaks about the triangle of that is bedwetting, setting fires, and animal cruelty. And animal cruelty is on the top of the list. Usually children who are involved in that type of thing oftentimes go on to commit acts of violence in adulthood. That's why it's very important to intervene in the lives of these young adults or young children early.
Yeah, because I have seen cases where children as young as 2 years old would be killing animals. I remember that myself when I was...
Wow, that's 7 years old.
Yeah, it is. It is. And they don't have any compassion for the animals. I remember myself at 7 years of age, I saw a little kitten. And it was so unfortunate that I tried to get the kitten outside on the street. There were homeless cats. And I tried to get the kitten out of the hole that it was hiding. And I thought that I accidentally, you know, by pulling the cat out, the kitten out, I think I must have damaged his eye. And I felt so horrible. I felt so bad. However, there are children that kill animals and they look at the suffering of the animal. And they're so young, 2, 3, 5 years old, and they are not moved at all by the suffering of the little creature.
I think as they get older, in the sense that they are moved, is that they are moved in a sense that is, maybe I'll call it dark, in that they receive some kind of excitement in that feeling. It's an intrigue. They're excited that they have some kind of control or power over that entity or being, animal.
Isn't that interesting that we can talk about something paranormal here, because a lot of the times that I hear in the scientific community, even the conversations that behind the minds of the killer and different psychopathies that we can find in humans, they are non-human entities. They call them, we cannot call them humans. There's something that stands behind them. And even those that identify as malignant narcissists, psychopaths, they do state that they may not be completely human. So something stands behind it, this animalistic tendencies to devour the one that does not probably belong to your clan, right? Or even belonging to your clan, you want to kill, right? To either to establish supremacy or sometimes just for pure fun. And that is scary.
I can understand what you're saying, how they don't seem of this world. However, I think we're animalistic by nature. I think with the evolution of the prefrontal cortex, which has allowed us to have cognition, that different, really our brain is bigger in a sense, differentiates us from a lot of other animals or species. The amygdala plays a big role in our limbic system. Let me try to stay on track here. I do think they're entities of this world. I just think that unfortunately, the hardwiring of the brain was changed in some people in childhood. For a majority of children, because they suffered at such great abuse. I mean, unfathomable abuse by the hands of their own caregivers.
What comes to mind is the story of the Emperor Caligula. I know that perhaps he's not the most famous one, but the Emperor Caligula, he reigned only Roman Empire for about probably 5 years. And he was particularly a malevolent emperor. He was so cruel to his environment, to people around him, to animals, he was eventually killed. But what, if you look at his history, at his childhood, he was there, of course, as a child, observing crazy behavior of people around him. If I remember that correctly, who was there? That was the emperor right before him that was also very cruel, and there were even parties that were created. I'm so sorry that I can't even speak about it that fast, because this story is not only fascinating, but they're really difficult to even to comprehend, to talk about it, and my mind compartmentalizes.
Try to disassociate.
I have to bring it back to normal. Yeah, because you want to go into this existential conversation and the line to even discuss that topic, because that such cruelty is awful. So what happened during his childhood, he was a child present at the parties of for nobility, and that would come to this extravagant palaces. However, those people that would come to the parties that belonged to Roman nobility, they would be humiliated. They would be beaten, they would be made to drink certain atrocious things, and tortured And little Caligula, he knew that in his mind, he understood that that was a normal thing to happen when it was not. So when he grew up, of course, he turned to be an even worse monster than the one that preceded him. Besides all of those crazy, abominable things that he did with people, one thing that probably will never leave my mind, thinking about Caligula, how, you know, that sometimes you cannot unsee, you cannot unhear things.
You're mentally tattooed.
Like mentally tattooed. What happened that he was, of course, bathing this Roman bath, right, sitting, and he would make little boys to come and swim under the water to come and bite his private parts as like little fish would do. And thinking of pathologists of that time, you know, perhaps now we don't talk about it as much, right? And those things do not become public. But at the time that it was, and it went into history. So thinking about Caligula and how he was made to be who he was ridiculed his entire life. And Caligula, the name Caligula means little shoes, right? Okay. And that name stayed with him. So he was belittled his entire life. So that grandiosity that he had and the desire to rule over the world was, of course, tremendous. But if we look at that, he was very brutal. And we can talk about a lot of psychopathologies. And somehow, those psychopathologies are prevalent in the ruling class. What would you say about that, Dr. Sherry?
Like, what do you
in
mean?
In the
like
ruling class, for in tsars, in kings, in emperors. That was, it's a very interesting observation that I have made. However, do you think that perhaps we know about them because they went into history and the people, it is also prevalent in the common people, right? That do not belong to nobility per se. So probably they also had in large numbers those psychopathologies. However, we don't know about it because it was never written in went into the history.
And it never would have been probably thought of a psychopathology back then, right? Because the term probably wasn't, it didn't exist. I think it's existed from the beginning of time. I mean, there has to have some reigning of hierarchy or power. You know, taking someone, I mean, what could give you more power than taking someone's life? I mean, that's a lot of power, a distorted perception of power. However, that's a lot of power to witness someone take their last breath on behalf of yourself. I mean, I don't know if you've ever heard of it. When I was living in San Diego, they had the Museum of Torture came into Balboa Park. And have you ever gone into that? Have you ever witnessed that? Or
no, I've never seen that.
It was so fascinating because it's like, I mean, and this is probably just takes you back to maybe the 1500s, 1600s, maybe the 16th, 17th century. That could be wrong on that, so don't quote me on that one. But it's like all these contraptions that they use to torture people. So, I mean, even looking back into something like that, that's not even on a individual psychopathic level. That's like where people would actually come to crowd around to watch. You know, people put into these certain devices where they may have been locked and drenched in honey and things would eat them alive, or their limbs would be pulled apart, or they're strapped to these chairs. It was a very fascinating museum. I'm intriguing.
Thank God I don't live in those times. Thank God that my idea of entertainment is totally different. But if you look at the Middle Ages, of course, how people were burned at the stake, right? The whole crowd would come. It would be announced that it would happen, right? And crowds would gather around and cheer and scream and yell, you know, so that was really concerning. But that was the entertainment of the time.
And the same thing happens today. media portrayal. That's why we're so intrigued. We don't, you can still show up to executions. Some people, not everyone, but some people are still, let me go on as far as say privileged to show up and watch someone to be executed, like a loved one who was murdered. You can still go, I think, and I believe in certain cases, the family can go in and witness that person being executed. So in a roundabout kind of way, it has trickled down. And the media portrayal, I mean, that's why we're so fascinated with these things. It's such a taboo. I've always been fascinated by it because I could not, it's so unfathomable to think about, like, just why people do that.
Yeah.
And what drives them to do that.
Although I did not see that in San Diego, I saw that in the Tower of London. And it does fascinate you just to see, just to imagine that there were human beings centuries ago that undergone such cruelty. And what happened, of course, that they would bring all of the torture devices into a different room. However, in the real place where the torture chambers were, now there is a gift store. Dr. Sherry, can you imagine there's a gift store in the torture chamber? If you just take yourself back in time, you would think that, oh my God, it is like a basement type, and it used to be a torture chamber. And you can only imagine how much pain was left behind. And the souls are, in fact, who were tortured to death in the Tower of London. Let's just take one place in history that the souls are not at peace. Of those people, they are not at peace, and they still roam the premises of the Tower of London. And I saw them with my own eyes. Well, now we're going to the science and the paranormal. We're overlapping here. Yeah, but those souls are unfortunately are not at peace. The violently killed people. So,
do they ever go at peace?
Huh?
How do they find peace? Do they ever go at peace? Like, from your experience?
In my experience, souls do look for peace, but they cannot find it. For example, I can tell you that the interesting story that happened when I was visiting the Tower of London, and I was intending to come back to the Tower of London to even interview everybody about their interesting experiences, because I was just taken aback. I started asking the guards somehow, what they call, like, beef eaters, something like that. And those guards, they live on the premises. And of course, they show you around the Tower of London. They don't particularly talk about the torture chamber. That was years back. But that would explain how everything took place in the Tower of London. And I remember myself that I was in that little chapel, absolutely small little bitty chapel on the premises of the Tower of London that used to be the palace for the kings and later became the prison. So I stumbled and I nearly fell, like, on the completely smooth surface. And there was nobody else that went to the chapel. You know, like, a lot of tourists, they just like to roam around, see things, and they're fascinated by the murders, all those stories, right? And I was there by myself and the guard. And he smirked. I'm like, what's funny about it? I nearly fell. And he said the interesting story is that on the same place, the queen, I believe that was a Queen Victoria, she also stumbled on the same spot. And she ordered for the floor, of course, the floor was not as it was today, it was a wooden floor, to be taken out, taken apart, and see what's underneath. And there were bones of all of those murdered people at the Tower of London. They were just like, put them there. And a lot of the times, people who were tortured to death in the Tower of London, they belonged to nobility. So she put them and made an effort to identify those bones, and they were put, they were given the proper, so to say, burial, but their bones are still in that little chapel. But another story that fascinated me, that I asked the same guard who lived there, he told me that since you're asking about those interesting stories about the people who were murdered here, just because they live on those premises, right? And he said, my wife and I would live in the one of the cells, of course, and there were rooms and they're modernly set up, right? And they were made into the living chambers, living spaces as we're used to them now. But before, they were just regular cells for the prisoners. And he said that there was this Count of Devereux. And that Count of Devereux, the interesting story was that I forget whose lover he was.
It was mine back then. He was my lover back then. I admit.
Yeah, he was a lover of one of the queens. And she gave him a ring and said, if you are ever in trouble, send me that ring and I will help you. So what happened when he was imprisoned at the Tower of London? He cannot really get out of it and personally deliver the ring to the queen. So he sent the maid. A maid never made it. Maid kept the ring.
Shucks.
Shucks.
And she lived happily ever after.
Yeah. And he was killed. So that was a story that he told me. But he also said that he found a picture, just because he lived in a cell of this Count Devereux, he found a picture, an image of him, and put it on the wall. And as soon as he told me that, I said, you got to be kidding me. You must be out of your mind. So the person finally left, even he was dead. He left this room, he left this cell, and you brought him back and hung it right on the wall where he spent his last days. And he said, it is funny that you say so, because he said, every time that I would leave the room and my wife would just leave the room, his picture would always find its way right by the door. And I said, no wonder, because he never wanted to be there. He was still alive, right? And his soul is alive. He does not want to be in the cell. And I asked him to take the picture off. I said, take his picture off the wall and just never put it there, because his soul is not at peace. And he said, another interesting thing that happened is that my wife, he said, always loses all of the rings in that room. And that was probably associated also with the story of the ring that never made it to his beloved queen, and he was murdered. So interesting. If we look at that, at the people that were brutally killed, and there would be innocent people that would be that would get into the web of the political scams, right? So that's interesting how their souls are not at peace.
So their souls aren't at peace. I mean, this is like a whole other show, right?
Yes.
Drifting into the paranormal of like a different show here. So if the soul's not at peace, that means there's not reincarnated? I'm not affluent with this topic. So I just ask, if a soul is still drifting, does that mean they're not reincarnated? Would that symbolize that?
Well, I believe just because they have still an unfinished business here on Earth, I believe they stick around. They okay. stick around. However, I heard, and I've also personally seen people whom I regressed, being a hypnotherapist, whom I regressed, who were in fact killed before. And they were reincarnated into these people, and they would have special birthmarks on their bodies that would indicate the way that they were murdered before in their previous life. This is so very interesting. And of course, if we talk about serial killers, it makes me think that when they die, what happens? Do they reincarnate to other individuals? And perhaps those individuals also somehow archetypally connected to their previous selves, right? And to their deeds. What Perhaps. Do you think about it? You're also a hypnotherapist, Dr. Sherry. Speak up. Tell us your perspective on that.
I haven't delved much into regression hypnosis or in reincarnation, so I don't have much experience with that foresight in it. I'm more of like alert hypnosis. I've practiced alert hypnosis, teaching people how to practice hypnosis awake, as well as just the basic hypnosis. I don't do much regression. But one thing that struck me when you were speaking about the bones, it's like how just finding someone's bones with all the science we have today, that the dead speak to us in that manner, like with autopsies and how they leave behind a story that the serial killer or the murderer, let's just put murder, it's not always a serial killer, but when you find it in that often case, it is. But it tells a story. And one thing that kept coming to me is like when you talk about killers, there's different types of killers, but they're also either organized or disorganized killers. So there are organized killers who are very methodical. They calculate their murders. They search out certain victims. They have their crime scenes are usually clean. They take precautions. And then you have the disorganized crime scenes or the murderers who are impulsive and reckless, and they oftentimes leave back a lot of evidence. So that's one thing that popped in my mind when you were speaking about the bones being under the floor of the Tower of London.
Chapel.
Mm-hmm. Chapel. And you have a very rich history. I like, it's very intriguing. You have very much a lot of knowledge in history.
Well, that I visited that place, and of course, I'm fascinated about the history. What fascinates me in the history and why I'm so that I have been reading books since I was very, very little. I remember that we had a huge library, and I would always, my favorite passing time would be reading books. And I remember that even not going to school, pretending to be ill at home so I could sit and read books. It was crazy. It was so crazy. But yes, that's essential to remember history so we would not repeat it. But we have the saying that history repeats itself. So how come we smart intellect, human beings with intellect, how come we repeat the history again and again and again? And even now, if we look at what happens in Palestine at this time, it is so horrible. And how we, now in our modern world, how are we capable of killing, murdering, or mass murdering other human beings? What gives us the right to do so? So
I don't think we have a right to do so, but I think that we're always going to struggle with that until there's some kind of let go of power and have more love, you know?
Yes, true. But it's so very interesting that you mentioned the neurological factors playing the role in psychopathology of the killer's mind, abnormalities in their brain structure and function. They do implicate the violent behavior, right? For example, even the dysfunction in the areas of brain that are responsible for impulse control, emotion regulation, and empathy, like you said, they predispose people to aggression and antisocial behavior. So yeah. That would be the imbalances in neurotransmitters such as serotonin and dopamine, you know, which regulate the mood and reward processing, may contribute to the development of violent tendencies, right?
Yeah, they have a slower, they have a slower response in detecting fear in others. And our own fear of these things are often what intrigues us to probe into these topics, because we are actually, we are facing our own mortality when we look into these types of what we would call like taboo-ish type behaviors. But a lot of these individuals who have committed heinous crimes have been inflicted with like severe childhood trauma. And even those who haven't, like for instance, a lot of people may go on to say like Ted Bundy, he supposedly he didn't have a terrible childhood. However, some people don't know that he had a sister, and when she was a teenager, she got pregnant and she was sent off, and his parents raised the child, and he thought his mother was his sister. So it was like he learned that later in life, which probably set something off. So it can be an array of things. But a lot of people, like there's the serial killer from Colombia, Luis something, and he murdered over, they think, at least 168 young boys. But when he was a child, he grew up in a family that was, his own father abused him sexually. They were violent alcoholics, his family. He would give him to the friends to abuse him and torture him. And he actually went on to do the same thing.
Yeah, like in the case of Caligula.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's the environmental factors, of course, play a role. And even
a big role.
Exposure to violent media, you know, also the peer influences, societal norms that glorify aggression, dominance, mm-hmm. ideology, exactly. They normalize the violent behavior, they desensitize people to its consequences. So that if we look at all those movies that have been mass produced by Hollywood, we look at that and we see there is so much psychopathology there that if you want to research anything, you don't even have to be a psychologist. Just go look at that. And in fact, not only that they glorify that, they show the tools, they show the methods how to kill people, not even understanding that the young people that are watching that, you know, if they have this inclination to psychopathologies, they will use those particular methods and you implement them in life, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So not only even the abnormalities in the brain function, right? It's also
attachment.
Yeah, yeah.
Childhood environment, modeling.
Childhood, yes. All this malevolence that they witnessed in childhood. And of course, for them, it is normalized. You know, at the beginning, it is so scary because even the child who witnesses a murder, for example, right at the beginning would be very scary. But then with more of them happening around, it becomes normal.
And a lot of people that commit these heinous crimes suffer from inadequacy. They were bullied in school. They never could amount to anything. So they just walked down that path. It was their way of gaining power back. It's their way of, by taking power over someone else, they're gaining their own control and power.
That's true. That's true. I was, watching the movie yesterday. Somehow was so compelled to see it. And it is such a moving, incredible movie. It's moving.
Can you share the name of it?
That was Good Will Hunting.
Oh, yes.
Such a fantastic movie. And Robin Williams played a psychiatrist there. And what's his name?
Matt Damon.
And Matt Damon was this delinquent youth that passed from one house to another, being in foster homes all the time. And of course, he was pushing everyone away. That was his way of dealing with the atrocities of his childhood. So what happened is that he became antisocial, of course, and it took a person who was really interested in him to heal him, to let him know, who also had a trauma, because this is the story of wounded healer. So Robin Williams says that psychiatrist, that's such a moving moment in that movie, that he comes to him, to Matt Damon, and he says, "It is not your fault." And Matt Damon's like, "Oh yeah, yeah, I know." But Robin Williams then repeats, "It is not your fault." "Oh yeah, 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 I know." Of course, that when the defense mechanisms kick in, that, yeah, I know that, nothing new here. And then Robin Williams continued persistently say, it is not your fault. And only then Matt Damon character broke into tears and was crying on the shoulder of his psychiatrist. So a lot of the times it is not the fault of those people who grew up in these atrocious conditions.
No, it's oftentimes the pair, it's our modeling, social modeling. But oftentimes it's if a child has a disorganized attachment and doesn't have love from the child, even if, you know, it's probably a very low percentage that's depicted in that movie that someone can move to break the barrier to form an attachment. After so many, you know, once you get to a certain age, if that hasn't been formed, I think it's very difficult to attain that for some people. Like, look at Eileen Wuornos. She was a female serial killer. And she went on to kill the Johns she was sleeping with because she engaged in prostitution. She was also in a same-sex relationship. And she killed, I think, 7 men with a gun. But she came from a very, very dysfunctional, disorganized family. She was on the streets homeless when she was a young teen. She was engaged in prostitution. I'm not saying a psychiatrist couldn't have saved her or helped her, but I just think there are some cases, unfortunately, that the trauma is so severe. Psychopathology or psychopathy is a type of disorder that is very difficult to treat, if it can be treated at all.
Well, then need to talk about how to define that the dark triad, right? What is a dark triad here? Narcissism, Machiavellianism, and psychopathy. So, and that stands behind the majority of the psychopathologies of the killers.
Mm-hmm. Right? Like, she went on to say, she's like, the world is full of evil. Mine just came out based on the acts I was committing. So hers, like, she's like, she just felt like we're all evil to a certain degree. Hers just came out. I mean, there's some crazy ones out there. There's people who, you know, there's cannibalists who have eaten children. I mean, there's a long list.
That is so horrible. You know, that we don't have to go far. You know, that if people never seen or heard about or never seen the way that the mind of a killer works. There is a great movie that was made to describe the psychopathology of the killers, written by the Robert Louis Stevenson, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You know, because he wrote the novel Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. That offers the compelling exploration of the duality of human nature and also the consequences of repressed desires and impulses. Mm-hmm. So if we look at that story, huh? Yeah, exactly. If we look, well, not necessarily, that could be bipolar, but probably what we could see is dissociative personality disorder there, because he dissociates. Could be also dissociative personality disorder, right?
I think it's more distorted perception with regard to people who are doing these crimes. I mean, they could be disassociating when they're... Do you think they're disassociating when they're committing the crime?
I think that they do. I think at the time of the murder, like you mentioned, the true psychopaths who lack any compassion, any empathy, who do perform the calculated crimes, perhaps for them, this is not the case.
No, they wouldn't be dissociating. They actually, you know, they would be like a thrill killer. Those are the ones that are like, yes. Just like, are the... I think the most profound to me, people who kill for thrill, for the simple fact of like to see someone suffer and to be tortured. That's wow. I don't think there's a disassociation there. I believe that they have this urge. It's an impulsivity, and it gets to a point where they can't control the impulse and they have to act out on it. That's why with serial killers, unlike mass murderers and spree killers, they have what's called a cooling off period. They take time to cool off. And serial killers often, they choose their victims at random, and it's often not people they know, which was so interesting. I think his name was Joseph Kondo. He murdered two young girls, but he actually was considered a serial killer, and he actually murdered people that he knew, their children. He actually befriended the parents of the children, which is not a very common thing among serial killers.
That is incredible. So what happened? How did that dynamic develop?
Well, he I watched him in an interview, and he just goes on to say it was easier because they trusted him. So it mm-hmm. made it that much easier for them. But he was a disorganized killer, so he left a lot of evidence behind. But just to befriend people, and he was he had substance abuse issues. But again, like when he's in the interview, it's never about the victim. It's always about, for the most part, what could they have done different? Whatever they talk about, they could have done different was just because they got caught. Oh, I wouldn't have done that because I got caught. It wasn't anything to spare the victim.
So there is only one remorse, that they got caught, and mm-hmm. not any remorse for what that they have done.
No, that's the only thing that would change, how they got caught. And that just shows that lack, that emotional deficit there.
Well, if we look at the differences between the narcissism, the dark triad, the narcissism, Machiavellianism, right, and psychopathy, narcissists are not necessarily the ones that would go on a killing spree. So also the Machiavellianism, people who, there's a Machiavellianism. It's like a complete evil and exploitation of other people for their own purposes, right? And then we have the psychopaths. And for the psychopath, for example, if Machiavellians, they are also having a dark minds and also lack empathy. However, they're going to be really good in groups. If you look at them, that they will be building teams, for example, they would be really good in the social setting, while psychopaths would not be.
Organized psychopaths can be. There is a difference. There are some people who lack empathy, but they can be organized. That like there are some psychopathic tendencies. But they have there's a higher level of intelligence with organized, mm-hmm. and there's a lower intelligence. So, but I understand what you're saying. Like more psychopathy may be on the lower intelligence, have a history of antisocial personality disorder, not so social. Whereas maybe like you're psychopathic with someone with just narcissism may have a higher intelligence.
And it takes a certain mindset at a time to murder someone, to do the calculated, to perform the calculated murder.
Meticulous. Right?
Just that the meticulous, mm-hmm. yes. So the narcissist, in my understanding, that they would pay someone, right, to kill, to whack someone that they don't like. However, that with the, in the case of psychopathy and those that are not socialized psychopaths, they would kill with their own hands, like you said, for the thrill.
And even reach out post. Like if you think of Dennis Rader, if you know him, he's called the BTK killer. He's the bind, torture, and kill man. Mm-hmm. He had a whole family that he was living a normal life. I think he was a park ranger, some sort, something like that. Don't quote me on that either. But he would send letters to the police, and that's ultimately what got him caught. But like that grandiose behavior of like, ha ha ha, not only did he thrill seek to kill people, he went on beyond that to send letters to the police department taunting the police that they wouldn't catch him.
I have always thought, what if, seriously, what mm-hmm. if I did not have empathy? Would I be able to empathy or even conscience? You know, because sometimes we can have too much conscience. Like I have too much. I'm highly
Well, you have to be conscious.
Conscientious.
Some type of conscious.
My conscience is that out of the roof. And I can feel bad for the consequences of my actions. And of course, I don't even perform those actions because I already think of the consequences that they can have on the people. But I always thought, what if I didn't have it? How much could I have achieved in life with a good heart? Not to commit those atrocious crimes, of course, but how much could we have achieved if we did not have conscience in this regard, right?
You would achieve anything.
Oh, hold on. This is not correct. Like conscious, like how can you not have conscience, right? Yeah, that the psychopaths may not. So I just thought that, what if we did not think of the consequences of our actions? So as human beings, of course, we're wired.
Set ourselves back hundreds of thousands of years. That's exactly what we would do. Because our brain has developed over time to develop a conscience of what we have today and social construction. So all you have to do is look in history. I mean, as history repeats itself, you could just look back and be like, well, how could someone have murdered millions of people? I mean, that's just kind of how I'm perceiving it. But well, even if you lacked empathy, how would you even know? You wouldn't know that you lacked it.
I wouldn't know. Exactly. Exactly. I wouldn't know. So interesting. So interesting.
And we're actually just socially constructed to be empathetic. I think we're inherently born with an inherent of empathy to nurture our children and our young.
Yes.
You know, so I don't think we're just born like to discard. Trauma creates it in our world today. I think trauma is a major environmental social construction. Trauma is a major factor. It's what we see and what we is modeled for us has a heavily influence. That's why so many people wonder why people, what people think about them. If we didn't care about all that, then we would just go about our happy lives every day and not care about the external factors.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But that is still, nevertheless, is very fascinating. And just the idea of even thinking about it shows you that you are human, mm-hmm. right? Well, ladies and gentlemen, you are live with us on United Public Radio Network, 107.7 FM. With the Be Honest show, where we are honest with you about everything we talk about. And we also want you to be honest with us back and ask you your questions and send us your stories that we can discuss here as well, if you don't mind. So we're talking today about psychopathologies. So what happens in the mind of a killer? I have to say, what happens in the mind of a killer? You know, that the killer, like, things so cheerful, of course. But it is a very interesting topic that fascinates people. We need to know what happens in the mind of this antisocial people in order to be able to protect ourselves, to defend, and not to be so gullible and believe what those, a lot of the times, charming individuals can do. They can persuade you into their charms, into their web of psychopathologies. And we have to be pretty careful about it. So psychopathy is, as we define it, can also be socialized psychopathy, where people around us, so they just exhibit antisocial tendencies, of course, but they are socialized. They are among us. And if you don't even know it, it could be your neighbor.
Yeah, they say on average there's at least 30 to 50 serial killers going on at a time. And that was just that, maybe that was done in like 2010 or something like that. That was said
in the world,
at least in America. I'm not sure if it's the world, because they're serial killers are not easy to catch, because they usually don't go after people that they love. It's usually random people. and it's so methodical, and you know, people go missing. Sometimes they're not found for years to come. It's only when these people get too grandiose or above themselves, I guess you could say, for a lack of a better way to put that, that they end up messing up. Everything always is revealed, right? But they end up like, I mean, look at John Wayne Gacy. He killed over 33 young men and buried them in the crawl space of his home. So the smell eventually came out, you know? But I know it's not laughable, but it's keeping it light here. But I mean, like, just patterns. These people leave behind patterns, and they're not easy to catch. What is your most intriguing thought? Like, what is the thing that bothers you the most about any case that you've read? What is the thing that, like, haunts you the most?
Well, there is a case that I remember as I was a child about the Andrei Chikatilo in Russia. And he was the one that would just shake the society profusely. He was known as the butcher of Rostov, or the Rostov's Ripper, right? What is Ripper? That he rips apart, right?
Ripper was one of the one that was never caught, I think, in England.
Yeah, but why was he called the Ripper?
Because they thought he might have had a hook in it or something, because he ripped them. Well, Andrei Chikatilo?
Yeah,
Andrei Chikatilo. Actually would, like, bite his victims, and he would mutilate them.
Ugh, that is.
And even in the court, like, he stripped out when he was in court. He stripped out and was like, "What am I supposed to do with this?" Like, his anatomy, his genitals didn't work when he was with his wife. It was only when he was committing a crime would he get aroused.
Do we know anything about his childhood?
I think. I know he survived, like, I think it was called Holodomor. It was a man-made famine in the Ukraine, mm-hmm. I think around the time of Stalin. Mm-hmm. His mother told him his brother was kidnapped. He had a traumatic childhood. He was bullied. He never felt he was adequate. His mother would ridicule him, say he would never amount to anything. Mm-hmm. So he was basically impotent. And his sister set him up as a with his wife. He was shy, he was bullied, so he kind of had the same pattern.
Yeah, growing up during World War II, yeah, and experiencing hardships and atrocities of the war,
he was a bedwetter, and his mother would ridicule him for it.
Wow. Yes, that is that makes us think, right, that it is so important to treat your children in a good way. But the thing is that when we become parents, we're not given the, that comes
a with handbook. It.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We don't have a handbook. That's right. We don't have a handbook. We're not given that how to raise children. We bring our own crazy, at times, childhood experiences into that, bring it up our children. And we cripple them just like we were crippled.
He was extremely smart. So he wasn't really categorized as a psychopath of antisocial personality disorder. He was actually more diagnosed with a borderline personality with sadistic features.
Sadistic features. So how come he did not fall under the category of the psychopath?
We probably overlapped because he was so smart. You know, he probably didn't. He kind of knew what he was doing. It's like when he started to kill, that's when he would get erections. Like, he would get aroused, and that's what led to him to, you know, I think he killed up to 90, but I think he convicted him of 52.
Yeah, convicted of 52. And he also confessed to 52 murders. And mainly he targeted runaways and prostitutes. Mm-hmm. And that's so interesting that his crimes were undetected for many years. As the Soviet authorities, they initially attributed the murders to random acts of violence and acts that normally happen in society, right? However, as the number of victims increased and patterns emerged in the killings, investigators began to suspect the existence of a serial killer, and they were right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's what it all comes down to as well. Just like when we talk about in other podcasts about when you're getting to know someone, how it's important to get to know them, because you can see patterns. Patterns are so important. That's how we connect crimes, or like connect serial killers to certain crimes, because we can see their patterns. In addition to the victimology, the medical exam reports, the police investigative reports, when you're criminally profiling, patterns, like what do they leave behind? You know, and the higher the intelligence and the more organized the psychopath or the killer, should I say, they tend to take souvenirs. They are the ones who tend to take trophies from their crimes. Yes. And revisit their crimes.
Yes, it's hard to even think about the Chikatilo's legacy. Even the last name Chikatilo, it already gives you the shivers right down your spine, because it's such a horrible last name, and is associated now with the murders. You know that his cases continue to be studied by criminologists and psychologists.
Yeah,
trying to understand the motivation and behaviors of serial killers.
Yeah, the most profound case that's always resonated with me has always been John Wayne Gacy, because he was called the Killer Clown, and Albert Fish. Mm. In addition to like Edmund Kemper and Ed Gein, I believe it was Ed Gein that they did the Silence of the Lambs, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and I believe American Psycho. I think that might have been Edmund Kemper, who he actually killed his mother. American Psycho was... I believe over Ed Gein, who was obsessed with his mother. But Albert Fish was a child rapist and a cannibal. And have you heard of him?
No, I have not.
He would like whip himself and stick pins into his body. So I think post-mortem, self-mutilation. And he actually lured a 12-year-old child named Grace Budd, telling her parents he was going to take her to a birthday party. And he was labeled the Moon Maniac or the Brooklyn Vampire. Are the murderer of a werewolf of Wisteria, I believe. And he lured her. He said he didn't rape her, but he sent a letter to the family saying that he ate her. So it was just like that. It's just always been so profound that these people, like, just mind blowing.
What is important to understand here, Dr. Sherry, I believe, is that we have to be so kind to our children and try to understand where they come from, what problems they have, because as those killers, they have a lot in common. They're all of this, their childhoods.
Yes, intervene.
Their childhood were so atrocious, so they decided to go themselves and hurt other people as they were hurt. So, and we can see the dynamics here, right? The pattern that they target prostitutes, runaways, misfits, people who are on their own, vulnerable, who cannot find themselves. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the times we have teenagers who run away from homes, who are so angry at the world, at themselves, so they become an easy prey.
Mm-hmm.
It is so absolutely, I believe, important to show kindness to our children, and not only to our children, to our other children as well that we see. Of course, we have to reprimand them for this bad behavior, right? But at the same time, we should see the human there, because they can easily fall prey to psychopaths like this, the antisocial individuals. Mm-hmm. Because if we ourselves are so critical also in our households with our children, and we never praise them, or we, of course, like we don't have the handbook, right? That if we are not warm people ourselves, how can we share warmth with our children, right? So if they run away, they look for some warmth and understanding someplace else. And those individuals, psychopathic individuals, they are looking for the prey in those people that are so vulnerable. So what happens? They come and they promise to the future victims, everything that they desire. They are fantastic human psychology detectors. They can read people so well, and they take advantage of it.
Yeah. Or they run away and they become those people. They become the perpetrators.
Or they become the perpetrators.
You would think if you have suffered, what's so perplexing to me as well is some of these people have suffered so much immense trauma, like brutally, like raped and murdered as children. I mean, raped as children, that they go on to do the same thing. And it was always so, it's profound that they actually commit the same crime instead of trying to protect children. Like they go out and carry out the same dynamic. That's what's so intriguing about it, instead of protecting. And that's why I'm an advocate for trying to create programs for children, and if they can't be mentored at home, that's why we have to lift up teachers, because teachers, it's a tough job to try to see each child in that classroom.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. That the all we can do is to try and succeed, try and succeed.
And do, yes, do what you can do.
It.
Do.
Exactly, because by trying, we can attempt to help people, of course, but if they don't want to be helped as adults, we can't do much there. But if they're children, we can knock through that shield that they put up in order to protect themselves from the world, and we can knock and finally have their hearts open up and talk to them, not just purely dismissing them, because essentially when they behave like that, they are asking for help and they just don't know how, and that is why they act up. And of course, it is such a complex dilemma, and every case is a separate case and needs a separate approach. So Dr. Sherry, I wanted to ask you, I know that you studied forensic psychology, so what are the techniques used to understand and catch killers?
Criminal profiling. To catch them, mm-hmm. evidence, you know, I mean, to profile them, to understand their childhood, where they come from, what you can find out about them, victimology, why did they choose that victim, and then what was their modus operandi, what was their mode of killing them, what was, you know, their strategy, were they disorganized, unorganized, where the crime took place. You can also police investigative reports, the medical examination, the autopsy, if you have a body, which most of the time that's what links the cases. Those are the types of things to catch somebody on the run, to try to link the patterns and where they might be next. How many people have been found in a certain location? Once they're apprehended, then you can go on to do psychological evaluations to determine their diagnostic criteria, such as AP, antisocial personality disorder, or so on and so forth.
What is so interesting to me that a lot of them, they plead the
not guilty by reason of insanity, which happens in less than 1% of the cases.
Just less than 1%. I thought it was more less. Prevalent than that.
Well, they may try, but they won't be convicted. They won't be acquitted of it. It's a very difficult thing to try to bring forth. And oftentimes you have to go through psychological testing to be deemed unfit to even, sometimes you're deemed unfit to stand trial. Same thing. Some people are deemed unfit to be executed. They're not
unfit to be executed.
That's like, to stand trial. But yeah, there's a, I believe that's also a notion there. They have to be deemed eligible
to be executed. You know, maybe it's a good thing that I'm not in the law enforcement, because I would plead for, what is it called?
No appeals.
No appeals, you know, just absolutely no damn appeals for those cases. Our legal system has so many loopholes. Every legal system has lots of loopholes that you can use to get away and not pay the price for the murders that you have committed, right?
Yeah, I think a lot of powerful systems in general are run by very powerful people who themselves may have tendencies of narcissism.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. That is why they are in a position of power. That's how it happens, right? Or it's psychopathologies, right? Psychopathy, that if we just look at that, if we take each person up there, of course, we may find something there, right? Something that is abnormal. And aren't we going to, in one of our following episodes, speak about abnormal psychology?
Yeah.
I think we are. Yeah. We are going to talk about it.
We're speaking about it now.
Yes, as well. Yeah, as a precursor to our future episode.
Mm-hmm.
And we can go in depth there as well.
Mm-hmm.
So now, of course, I would go for a death penalty. And somehow it is not, it was canceled here in the United States, right? Or not?
Oh, no. Well, it was at one point.
Each state is different, right?
Some people's executions were commuted, right? So they were like, I think Charles Manson was one of them, may have been in that era where they couldn't be given the death penalty because it was off the table. They have it now. People are being executed. And now they even have a new technique where I believe it's a different type of gas that they're inhaling to perish.
That
it's no longer just lethal injection, which is considered humane.
Humane, exactly.
And I think at the end of the day, if we separate the way we feel and the crime they committed, at one point, these people were just children. They were just people. And, you know, if you believe that people aren't created monsters, at one point they were just human beings. So that's why I think there's that notion that they should, despite what they've inflicted on other people, that they should be given a humane treatment. I believe being locked away for the rest of your life is a lot harder than dying.
Well, it depends. It depends. If we employed all of the torture techniques that they used in the Middle Ages, including the Spanish,
goodness,
you know, that would have been probably the solution for them. And in my understanding, that they have to be tortured for the rest of their lives with not giving them the chance to die. They should be brought back to life every single time and tortured again and again and again. So, but unfortunately, all of those are back in the Middle Ages. But however, I guess in the at the war, at different places, they are tortured that way. But for the murderers that live in the peaceful societies who have nothing else to do with their damn lives and who go on a spree to kill people, to calculate and then murder them, commit all those atrocious crimes, they need to be all sent to Gulag, to the labor camps. You know, that is my understanding. Labor camps.
Well, I think labor camps would be a great idea, you know. But then that gets taken advantage of too, because I believe here in Louisiana, there's a really prestigious prison called Angola Prison. And they used to have prisoners who would do such a good job building things that they didn't want to release them back into the public. And in addition to that, I believe the reason we have appeals is because so much corruption has taken place that you have people who are being exonerated for crimes they didn't commit.
That's
why it's a slippery slope, because, you know, you could be murdering someone or executing someone, excuse me, for a crime they may have not committed. But I think sometimes it's without a reasonable doubt, you know. I mean, it's up there.
Like the serial killers. I had here, in fact, a few years back, I got acquainted with a pastor, and he had his church. So interesting, not a big church. However, the things that he was able to do with his church and even to get his own business on the side up, he spent 10 years wrongfully convicted in prison, for which he received $100,000, and that was it. It was $100,000, but nevertheless, it was something that he was being able to use to start his business, and he became a pastor. He was not a pastor before. He was one of the, people on the streets, in the gangs, and that's how he was wrongfully convicted.
Yeah. I mean, there's just a gamut of types of killers. I mean, you know.
Yeah. But so interesting that we would have those experiences in order to lead us to where we probably should be. Like, he became a pastor, spending 10 years in prison and also preaching the Bible there to the inmates. It's a very difficult also topic here that we're discussing, you and I, Dr. Sherry, because it's a lot of people were wrongfully convicted.
And all that's why the appeals process is so long, because of that reason. Even though there's some of them, it's beyond a reasonable doubt that they killed their children, you know, or not their children. I guess we haven't really delved into that part, the familial side and people who kill their own children and their own families. That's another
type of... So what happens with them? What happens with those people?
I think there's different motives for people who kill, right? There's financial gain, there's power and control, there's psychological dysfunction, there's sexual pleasure, there's psychosocial aspects, there's ideological beliefs. There's so many different motives as to why people kill. Andrea Yates drowned her children, all five of them, you know, because she heard the devil, basically, or a demon tell her that she needed to save her children, and that meant killing them.
So, isn't that something that the religious cults do?
Somewhat.
Yeah.
You know, she was, I believe they lived in a camper, a small home. But yeah, she took out all her children. And I believe she's still committed to a psychiatric facility, which she'll probably spend most of, if not the rest of her life there. But then you have other people like who just kill family members. Like, could be relatives. Doesn't even have to be their own, like, children. It could be relatives. It could be, or murder suicide is very popular. Some people get so financially stressed out that they might murder their family.
Yes, that famous case in Amityville in the 70s, where I don't remember his name, who killed his entire family, just shot them to death while they were sleeping, all five of them. Mm-hmm. And but that the place was allegedly haunted, right?
Yeah, I think they did the Amityville Horror, and I believe the Conjuring movie may have been based on that, but I don't recall if that's right.
Yeah, but it is exactly that was the sequel, right, that they would make. But a lot of the times that perhaps even the homes in which people live, they can have sometimes even a black mold. Black mold can cause psychosis. Black mold can cause hallucinations. So if we just look at that, how environmental factors affect human beings, it's easy to see that, although it is not so easy to see if that was the black mold that was at works right behind the scenes of the people who murdered
them. That would then be derivative of a psychosis, right? That would have some kind of infliction of a psychosis, right? Like black mold must cause something in the brain to be distorted.
Absolutely. So that's what happens. Yeah, they have audible hallucinations. They have visual hallucinations. And that's what happens. They hear voices that would tell them to go kill. But where do they come from, all those voices? If people hear them, where would they come? Perhaps they undergone some sort of stress, right? For example, the mother who killed all of her children, all her numerous children, she would have been under crazy stress.
Postpartum was played a role in that.
Postpartum, severe stress, of course, of bringing the family. It's it plays a role. Yeah, but like you said, they were children at some point in time, right? And they're
all human beings at the end of the day.
They're human beings, but it's really difficult to see them as human beings.
Yes,
very difficult.
Yes,
to look at Ted Bundy. Yeah, to look at Ted Bundy's face and the interviews, he was so malevolent. And I believe that there was no human nature in him at all.
He escaped prison twice.
Oh, he did?
Mm-hmm. They caught him. He was nabbed, I think, after 8 days in the first one, and I think he was found like maybe 14 days later in Florida for the last one. He actually got out of jail or prison, whatever he was in at the time, and he escaped twice.
Isn't that interesting? By doing what? How did he manage to run away from high security prison? You tell me.
One, he jumped out of the window of a courtroom, of the second floor window, I believe, in the first one. And the second one, he dug a hole in the ceiling and went through the crawl space.
In the ceiling?
In his bulk, I believe.
Just, yeah, but that's interesting that how even when the legal system has loopholes, even the ceilings, the prison has loopholes through which prisoners may escape. That is incredible.
Oh, what about what about mercy killings? Excuse me. Like, people who like Donald Harvey, he was like a nurse or an orderly, and he killed like 70 people, I think, in the hospitals. He would do cyanide or he'd suffocate them.
Because is it because that the
he felt like they
compassion.
But there's no compassion because they're not giving you the authority to take their life. You're taking it upon yourself. Because he said, well, they didn't have hospice at the time. And he figured that he knew he wouldn't want to be like that. So he stepped in and murdered them.
Took charge into his own hands. How old were those people?
Most of them were elderly. I think he even killed a friend, like a neighbor. Like he believes he's rehabilitated. And so there are some like that said if they ever got out again, they'd kill again.
They would kill again. Yeah, that's the interesting part about it, that if those murderers don't get convicted and somehow they escape the legal system, right? They are going to go and do that again and again and again. And that's unfortunate. That is so unfortunate and makes me sometimes I have this existential dread and angst even thinking about it because the world has never been a safe place.
That's good. You're confronting your own mortality. That's healthy.
Yeah. I'm here right in the session with Dr. Sherry. Dr. Sherry, please. Yeah. Yeah, I am. I am. And I have been since childhood. The topic of death has always been very scary to me. And little by little, through the exposure therapy, I have been my own psychotherapist. I would just, through the exposure techniques, I would just go and conquer. And nevertheless, that topic, even if I'm able to go to funerals and even talk to the family members of the deceased person, because before I couldn't, I would just freeze, unable to talk, even utter the words of condolences. I wouldn't be able to do that. Wow. Now I can do that. Yes, because I had my own shocking experience when I was little, when my grandfather died. And it just makes me feel that the world is so unsafe and we have to be prepared for anything. You know, it's difficult to be vigilant all the time, but nevertheless, we have to develop vigilance in ourselves to know what is around us, be able to read people and not fall prey for the first person that comes to us and shows kindness.
And charisma and charm.
Charisma and charm.
Yes. Make sure when you have a lucky charm, it's a clover, not a person.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Dr. Ramani, she is a professor at UCLA, and she just recently published yet another book. And she's so fantastic. And she talks about narcissism, Ramani Durvasula Ramani. And she says, in fact, that because she had a lot of personal experiences with narcissists, she said that now, every time that she encounters a charismatic person, she doesn't fall for this charisma at all. She knows that there is some sort of narcissism present.
Yeah. Especially in the beginning, right? Now, some people just some people naturally have charisma, but there are people who have superficial charm. That's different.
That superficial charm, we have to turn on our intuition and know if there is something that goes against you at the time, that means it's true. So listen to yourself and listen to your gut feelings, to your intuition, and walk away.
Yes, don't listen to your loneliness.
Don't listen to your loneliness, and especially teach your children. Teach your children about the world that there is around them, because a lot of the times that the children grow up and modern high schoolers, for example, they know a lot that, for example, I did not know 1/10 of what they know right now. Nevertheless, we have to educate them of what happened there in the world and the psychopathologies that there exist. You don't have to be a psychologist in order to talk about them. But as my grandfather taught me when I was little, he said, listen, he said that you have to have eyes in front of you, that you have two eyes. You have to have two eyes on the back of your head. You have to have two eyes above you and underneath you, and on all of the sides of your body. You should always be aware what is happening around you. So he would go, just like I did with my children as well, that I would be in either outside or in some sort of event, for example, and I would always ask my children, just like my grandfather did, said, okay, you're here. Did you assess the situation in the room? Did you walk in? Did you know already? Did you took a good glimpse at everybody that was in the room, for example? What is happening? What is the dynamics? What is everybody expecting? What do they look like? And you have to be able to be aware. That is probably not everybody's cup of tea, but some people may argue and say that, oh, that will just become make us be paranoid. No, it would prepare us for certain conditions that at some point in time in our lives, the psychopath will come, the narcissist will definitely be there. And you must recognize the signs of those pathologies and defend yourself. So that is why Dr. Sherry and I are here going live with you every single week to talk about things that can go wrong and things all that right. Actually go right. Yes, exactly. Can go right and wrong. And to give you our expertise and share the advice and hopefully to get stories from you and your experiences, please write to us. We will respond. We already received a few stories and questions through the email for which we are thankful, and we are happy to read. We read every single email. Please write us more, and we will discuss it on the live radio. So, we have been discussing the psychopathologies and what happens in the mind of a killer. So the pathology of the mind of a killer is a multifaceted phenomenon that involves a complex interplay of biological, as we discussed, psychological, social, and also environmental factors. While there's no single cause or explanation for violent behavior, the research, as we discussed, suggests that underlying mental illness, trauma, socialization, and neurological dysfunction all can contribute to the development of a killer's mindset. And so by addressing these factors through comprehensive intervention, treatment efforts, societal efforts, we can work towards reducing the incidence of violence and promoting mental health and well-being for all people, if that is possible at all. But we will always try.
That's right.
So Dr. Sherry, what are we talking next time?
Well, abnormal psychology. We're going to surf a little bit more on the wave of psychopathy.
Exactly.
Abnormalities in the neural part of our lives.
We will be unlocking the mind, right? We will come and unlock our own minds, Dr. Sherry's and I, and we will discuss abnormal psychology. So come and join us next Friday. We will tell you something very interesting. Meanwhile, you've been with us live on United Public Radio Network, 107.7 FM, on Be Honest Talks podcast and the radio show. So with thanking you for joining us today. And Dr. Sherry and I wish you a happy and wonderful rest of your day.
That's right. Happy St. Patrick's Day coming up. So are you gonna are you interested in going into a graveyard tour? Are you
what's that?
Can you walk into a graveyard? Is that one of the since you're like
graveyard?
We have a couple more seconds. I figured I'd ask.
Yes. You're so interested. Yes, I can go to graveyards.
And, okay, and so that doesn't bother you. Okay.
Right, the cemeteries, right? I could go, and especially if they're old, but this is not my favorite passing time, of course. But if I have to, I will go. But I don't really like doing that. But thank you for asking.
Okay, you're welcome.
All right. Well, hugs, everyone. Have a fantastic day, and we will see you next Friday.
Oh,
bye.